It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today we talk to an inventive musician in Austria who may be throwing a monkey wrench into winemaking. Now, if the scientists that he's been working with have gotten things straight, winemakers may be signing up orchestras and singers by the hundreds. And those companies that rework wines to duplicate high-scoring vintages, well, they just might have to find another line of work. So stay with us for more of this, a stock exchange for beer, the Brisket Chronicles, and your calls this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Washington, D.C., like other cities, has its share of craft beer pubs and local breweries. But reporter Rebecca Shear found a place that has made the economy part of its draw.
It's Friday night at the Big Board, and the beer and burger joint is hopping as customers chatter, watch sports on TV, and sip from glasses.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking the Ranger IPA.
Of beer on tap.
You're drinking a beer. What are you drinking?
Kilkenny.
But here's the thing. In the time since these people bought their beers, the prices...
And how much did you pay for that Ranger IPA?
It was $5.50 at the time, and now it's gone up to $6.50.
Have changed.
How much did you pay for that Kilkenny?
This was actually $5.75 a little while ago. The prices fluctuated a great deal. Actually, the market has reset itself, so it's back to $7 now.
So all this talk of price fluctuations, markets resetting, we're at a bar, right? I mean, what exactly is going on here?
The algorithm changes depending on how many people are here, what day of the week it is, what type of beers are being ordered. But the simple essence of it is the more type of beer that somebody orders, the lower the price goes.
Eric Flannery is a D.C. resident, Navy veteran, and co-owner of The Big Board. The Big Board is closed on Tuesdays, so that's when I swing by to meet Eric and another co-owner, his brother Mark.
Hey, I'm Mark.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca. Nice to meet you.
Who once was a sous chef in France and now teaches French in D.C. public schools. Next to the bar, hanging on the wall, is the Big Board itself, a flat-screen TV with the words real-time quotes atop a blue and red chart that looks kind of like a stock page. As Mark points out, the column all the way to the left lists the product, a.k.a. the draft beers.
Guinness, Chocolate City, Yinling Lager, Ranger IPA, Peroni Lager, Allagash White, Kilkenny, and Miller Lite.
And of course, each beer is listed with a symbol.
And like Guinness, our symbol is going to be G-U-I-N because we have envisioned that scrolling under each one of our TVs will be a ticker.
Next to the symbol column, you see the market price.
Whatever price the beer is being sold up at that moment.
Then the base price.
And this is where maybe we differ from the stock market, where the stock market hot commodities raise in price. Our hot commodities lower in price, and the base price is what we've decided that no customer will ever pay more for a beer.
So if I come in and I'm totally jonesing for like an Allagash, if I convince a bunch of other people in the bar to also order Allagash, the price will then go down?
That is pretty much exactly what will happen.
Though, as we heard before, the market regularly resets itself. So every hour, the game starts all over again. Mark, Eric, and Big Brother Doyle, who's currently serving in the Navy, founded the Big Board with longtime friend Dave Drain. Mark says as they grew up together in Northern Virginia, they always dreamed of opening a neighborhood restaurant and pub. As for the specific idea behind the Big Board...
Our buddy Dave saw the one in Barcelona, and we thought that would be a great idea. It's not done in D.C.
So they decided to give it a go. But they wanted more than just a cool concept.
We know that we wanted a place where people came back because it's a friendly atmosphere, and the food was good.
Which is why they take special pride in not just their beer, but their burgers, which they say are selling like hotcakes. And their beers are selling like hotcakes, too, albeit variably priced hotcakes.
We recently paid $6 for the Copper City Ale. What are the prices now?
Still $6.
Well, $6 for now, anyway. But remember what Mark Flannery said about wanting more than just a fun concept, but a friendly atmosphere, too? He and his fellow co-owners see the big board's ever-changing prices as just another way to achieve that friendliness. And customers are agreeing.
This gives you more of an opportunity to like interact with the bar itself, with the establishment.
After all, if you turn to the strangers sitting next to you and convince them to help you drive down the price of your favorite brew, who knows? You just might be brewing a lasting friendship. I'm Rebecca Shear.
Rebecca Shear is host and producer of Soundbites at WAMU in Washington, D.C. Well, now, the country that cooks with beer more than any other is Belgium, and one of its classics is a pork stew with dark beer, lots of onions, little sour pickles, and dried plums. It's another stew for gatherings. Brussels pork carbonades is on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, you can improvise a vegetable version with Brussels sprouts, potatoes, carrots, etc., instead of the pork, and it's pretty swell. Jane and Michael Stern find great local food. They report on it on their website, roadfood.com, and they stop by here. Jane, Michael, welcome, guys.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. So where have you been lately?
We've been traveling through Cajun country, southern Louisiana, and it dawned on us as we were traveling that one of our very favorite types of road food restaurant is a restaurant that is located in the proprietor's home. There's something obviously very homey about it, but it's especially wonderful at a restaurant called Johnson's Boucanière in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is the Cajun capital of Louisiana, because what's great is that the Johnson family can go downstairs from their upstairs apartment and get the smokehouse going at about 3 a.m. so that by daylight, the air all around their home and restaurant is perfumed by the smell of smoking pork shoulder, ribs, tasso ham, brisket, and sausage. It's a great Cajun restaurant, and there's something especially wonderful that it has been in the Johnson family since the 1930s.
So are you sort of eating in their living room? I mean, is it actually you're eating in the house?
Yeah, and then when you're through eating, you go to bed in their bedroom.
They wash the dishes. Right. No, they live upstairs, and there's a kind of restaurant-like area downstairs. I mean, you don't actually dine in their home, but they're on premises upstairs all the time. And the thing is, what's great is it's a real restaurant in the sense that it's not just limited to a few things from the smokehouse. They also make jambalaya and gumbo that is out of this world. Of course, smoked meats are involved in both of those. And they even have a great salad that they make. It's kind of like the old Memphis barbecue salad that they include shreds of smoked pork on top of, sort of like a chef salad, but a smokehouse chef salad.
Right.
It's a wonderful thing to eat.
Is there a particular Cajun style of barbecue?
Not like Eastern Carolina or Western North Carolina. Not in that sense. I mean, what they use here is oak wood primarily.
I disagree with you.
Okay.
I think that, you know, it's not like a huge, huge difference, but Cajun barbecue relies less on the sauce than other types of barbecue would. And because it's Cajun or Creole, it's very highly spiced. You know, I mean, everything that's cooked in that part of the world, they use a lot more than salt and pepper.
Although it's interesting because one of the things they make at Johnson's Boucanière is Boudin sausage, you know, which is sort of the signature dish of Cajun butcher. And what's interesting is that their Boudin, unlike some others, is not ferociously hot. I mean, it's spicy. There's a pepper kick to it, but it's much more mellow. I mean, you really taste the kind of sweetness of the pork and the starchiness of the rice and that flavor of the green onion that goes into it. It's much more harmonious than the kind of sausage that really, you know, knocks you out with its pepper punch.
And is rice always the side? I mean, this is not the place where the potato salad and the coleslaw comes
no
with
potato salad. And of course, that's one of the things that's great about Boudin sausage is that it's everything in a casing. It's got the rice, it's got the meat, and it's got the spice, and it's got the onion. So if you want to, and in fact, what a lot of people do at Johnson's is to just buy a few lengths of hot Boudin ready to go, walk out to their car and lean against the car, squeezing out the Boudin along with maybe a pile of saltine crackers and a bottle of beer. And it's a great al fresco luncheon.
God, I love that part of the country.
Yeah.
And I also love it because it's the only part of the country that I've ever seen that has drive-through daiquiri booths.
You're kidding.
No. And you don't have, I mean, at least the ones I've been to.
The law says that you can go through a drive-through daiquiri booth and get the daiquiri as long as there is a cover on the cup. What you cannot do while you're at the booth is to put the straw into the cover. You have to drive away from the takeout window to do that.
And wait a minute. Hold it one second here. So you can put the straw into the cup as you're driving down the highway?
As you leave the booth.
I understand. When you're 5 feet away from the booth, you can put the
straw. They're not responsible. In other words, the place that sells you the daiquiri is not responsible for you putting the straw in the top of the cup.
I think we'd better just leave this one on the table.
Yeah, okay.
You don't want to go into the 8 different strengths of daiquiris that you can get there?
No.
All right.
And I'm not giving legal advice here. Don't blame me.
Okay, back to the sausage and the Boudin. Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn. Jane and Michael Stern are the brains and the discerning appetites behind roadfood.com. All that talk of Louisiana got me thinking of catfish, and catfish brings me to one of the best tasting party dishes I know. It's Vietnamese caramelized catfish. It's inexpensive, you do it ahead, which is not the usual thing with fish recipes. And you probably have not tasted anything like it before. Now, the catfish is cut into little steaks, and it's glossed like shiny mahogany. You've got this deliciously sticky caramel glaze that seeps into the fish, and it tastes of garlic and black pepper and things that you can't quite pin down, so you just keep going back for more. Now, I like the recipe from Vietnamese authority Andrea Nguyen. So you can find her caramelized catfish sand pot. That's the pot they use in Vietnam to make it. Anyway, the recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a minute with the newest take in wine, Sonar Wine, and the Brisket Chronicles. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you want to impress strangers, serve them filet mignon in all its tasteless tenderness. But if you want to make those strangers your friends, cook them a brisket. Now, that's some of what you're going to learn if you read between the lines of Stephanie Pearson's quirky new book. It's called The Brisket Book, A Love Story with Recipes. And it came out of her year's sabbatical as a brisketeer. Well, Stephanie joins us. Stephanie, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So, Stephanie, tell me what you learned in this year as what you call a brisketeer.
I learned that everyone loves brisket and that brisket is the ultimate comfort food. I learned that it is a multicultural wonder. It's served all over the world. I learned that there's an emotional connection with brisket that really doesn't exist with very many other foods and not really very much with other meats like chuck and skirt steak. You just don't feel the love.
That's a good point. I've never heard anybody go on and on about chuck or skirt steak.
They just don't. They don't even have like a Facebook page or anything.
That's true. Brisket has a Facebook page?
Well, thanks to me, Brisket does have a very thriving Facebook page, which I update like every 2.5 seconds. But when I was researching, I also discovered that pork has a National Pork Month. Steak, of course, has steakhouses. Beef has the Beef Council. Veal has a PR agency. Chilean sea bass, I saw, had a Facebook page, and I thought, oh, poor brisket has nothing. But now it has me.
Oh, this is good. But, you know, there's something I find very confusing because I don't think a lot of people know what the brisket really is.
People don't know what it is. They don't. And also, but what people do know, it has not as much as fruitcake, but it has a certain negative perception. I think in some ways that it is a tough cut or that it's a difficult cut to be cooking. So it doesn't get great press.
Why don't you explain? I mean, give us the nuts and bolts of how to buy a brisket, where it comes from, what we should look for.
I will. I like nuts and bolts with brisket. It's funny. But the basics are brisket comes from the chest of a steer. And one of the first things I learned was a steer is not a cow. Everybody yelled at me. I kept calling it a cow. It's a steer. It's a neutered male. So brisket is right on the chest. And because a brisket is way up front in the four quarters of the animal, it's very tough. All the meats that are in the four quarters of the animal are very tough because that's where the hardworking muscles are. That's where the animal grazes and lies down and uses so many muscles that it's an enormously tough piece of meat that's very, very, very muscular. One of the joys of that is that because it's in the four quarters, it's kosher. So whereas a sirloin or filet mignon might not be kosher, this is. So there are two cuts of brisket that you can cook with. And on the very outside of the steer is what's called the point. And below that is what's called the flat. And when you barbecue a brisket, and anybody who barbecues a brisket knows this, you cook both together, and it's called a packer cut. But what you do have is a choice between a flat and a point.
Okay, so what I'm picturing is that if you buy a whole brisket and it's called a packer, there's a flat side of it that is probably about 2 to 3 inches thick, and it's maybe about 6 or 8 inches wide. Right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Then as you go up the whole piece of brisket, there's another side to it that's called the point. And that's much bigger, much thicker, and a bit wider. And that has a lot more fat. And that's
right.
From the front of the animal. That sits right between the front legs of the animal.
Exactly.
Which cut do we want to get the juiciest brisket that we can make?
It doesn't really make a huge difference as long as you have enough fat on either piece of the meat. And brisket's a very forgiving cut, especially if you're making a braised brisket. Braised brisket is incredibly easy to make as long as you know that you have to cook it. What's called low and slow is the cooking mantra.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the cooking mantra for all types of brisket, no matter what type of brisket you're cooking, which could be a barbecued brisket or it could be making corned beef, brining it. It's always a low and slow temperature, and you need to make sure that you have enough liquid to keep it nice and moist throughout so that it doesn't dry out.
So the old business about the Lipton's onion soup mix or, you know, a ton of onions or whatever, as long as the heat is really low and you've got a fair amount of liquid in there, you can have good brisket.
Exactly. The ultimate combination and the very best one is brisket and onions. It's so moist and lovely and sweet. But to your point, you can use anything from ginger snaps to cranberry to Coca-Cola to red wine to white wine to stout. Brisket is, as I said, quite forgiving of ingredients.
So you've eaten all of these perfect briskets. What brisket are you eating now?
My favorite brisket at the moment, and it is like picking your favorite child, so it's just like a terrible thing to have to do that. But at the moment, I fell in love with Roberta Greenberg, who is the assistant to the rabbis at Temple Emmanuel in New York. Roberta Greenberg cooks her brisket with cranberry slices. She also does a rub on it the night before, a little rub, and then the next day you cook it with onions and cranberry, and the cranberry caramelizes. So it turns into this incredibly ambrosial, sweet, lovely, silken gravy and just a wonderful, amazingly succulent brisket.
Stephanie, that sounds positively alluring. Thank you.
You are very welcome.
The Brisket Book, A Love Story with Recipes, is Stephanie Pearson's latest work. Now, for holidays or just for weekend dinner, try my mother's brisket. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. American Idol cast-offs might be signing contracts with winemakers. Why? because a French horn player and wine lover in Austria created something that might rock the wine world. He is Marcus Bachmann, and he is on the phone from Vienna. Good to have you with us, Marcus.
Thank you.
What is this creation? What have you created?
It's a total new kind of wine fermentation process using music during the creation of wine. And I put a speaker in the wine tank, a special one, and the music occurs unaltered and undisturbed, so the music has the most possible impact on the wine.
Wait, this and is a speaker that actually goes into the wine as
exactly.
It's fermenting?
The speaker is in the middle of the must, in the wine juice, so to say, and then the music is going to be played into the wine. And then the special thing is that the yeast starts doing total different things to the wine.
Now, I think I better explain one thing, that the way wine is made is the juice is pressed, right? And that's called the must. And then yeast is added to the must to encourage fermentation. And it's been proven that, right, Marcus, that music does affect plants. And yeast is essentially a plant. So you've taken that idea and you've added little speakers right in the middle of the liquid, which is remarkable, and you're playing music, which is affecting the yeast plant. Have I got it
right? Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. The speaker only has got the magnet and no membranes. So actually the fluid, the wine fluid, is the membrane.
Ah.
So everything that comes out of this middle magnet, the sound, it's audible. You can hear it. And it mixes the yeast due to the movements of the waves. The yeast doesn't have to use energy to go and eat. So everything comes in front of her mouth, so to say. Yeah, that's and because of that energy, what she doesn't need anymore, she does different kind of alcohol. It's then the higher alcohol, it's glycerin, which is known for this very mouthful, very high and rich aroma. And at the same time, it uses all the sugar. So we have got actually then a very dry wine, but with the flavor up front, sometimes also sweet.
Huh. How does it taste? Does it taste different?
Oh, yes, definitely. It tastes very rich and very mature. So you have got a young wine, which has got the fruitiness plus the taste of an old wine, like 3 years old wine. And it also tastes like wooden, but it has never seen a barrel. Because due to that the sugar is out, you have much more flavors coming out. Normally, the problem is that you have too much sugar in a wine.
Right.
So if a very pure, rich wine, and like we say, like the windows, if you turn a glass, you're going to see only one big window and not dripping down a lot of drops. So it makes it very oily, so to say.
Ah, when you tip the wine against the glass, you look for legs or you look for sheets. And
exactly.
The thicker wine, the wine with more body, will create a sheet against the glass and not legs. I understand what you mean. All right, but here's the big question. What kind of music do you play? What's the key in the music?
The key in the music is it depends really on frequencies. I mean, the yeast hasn't got earphones on, yeah, but it's in the frequencies. And then it's, of course, it's the volume and it's the pulse of the rhythm, and that mixes it, and it's like mixing, and that keeps the yeast much more alive. And there's more than 30% more living yeast in the fermentation than to compared wines without music.
That's amazing.
So it's very alive and very active.
They're still eating the sugar, which may account for the maturity of the wine in taste.
Yeah. So all the wines we have produced already have got a musical theme to it. That's the second part, to have an orchestra which has got his own wine with his own compact disc.
So you have a wine called Aria, right?
We have got several names. We have got one called Wiener Blood, which is operetta arias, of course. Then we have got New Year's Concert. Of course, we are an Austrian, and we have to do wines with that. But we also have got coming up a rock band, an Austrian rock band. We have got piano players. So it's an individual wine product.
I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of change in wine marketing in the future, Marcus. Thank you.
We're going to see.
Thank you for talking with us. This is pretty fascinating.
Thank you.
Marcus Bachmann is Managing Director of Sonar Wines in Austria. Paul Lucas is not buying the story that we usually hear about wine's history. Now, that is, what we drink today is the same as what Socrates and Julius Caesar and Cleopatra were sipping at banquets with their gilded dormouse. Well, Paul's an English professor at Loyola University in Maryland, and he's an award-winning wine writer. Usually, Paul critiques wine, but he's also intrigued by its history. And for 20 years, he's been researching wine's evolution. His discoveries don't quite agree with what we've heard before. They're in his latest book, Inventing Wine, A New History of One of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures. Paul Lucas, it's good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back.
So, Paul, what exactly were Socrates and Julius Caesar and Cleopatra drinking back then, and how is it different from what we drink now?
There are two big differences. They were, one is chemical. They were drinking wine made of grapes, but wine that was severely oxidized and that had all kinds of additives to it, most notably pine pitch or resin that acted as a preservative, so that you wouldn't really taste the fresh fruit, the fresh grapes in wine. You would most likely taste sort of ooey, goozy, pine fallish stuff.
Sort of like the Greek wine we used to know, the Ritzina?
Except Ritzina is very fresh and bracing, and this would be oxidized, so probably more brown than yellow. More often made out of dark-skinned grapes than light-skinned grapes, and thick and sticky, almost the consistency of goo.
Oh, does not sound very refreshing.
Refreshing. Does not sound like the wine we drink. And the other big difference is people in the ancient worlds, and going much farther back than ancient Egypt, had very different ideas of what wine was and what it was for than we have today.
What kinds of ideas?
Well, we today think of wine as secular, sometimes refined. Sometimes people think of it as being a fetish, but a pleasure, a worldly pleasure. To the ancients, wine was a gift from the gods. It was something that always had sacred significance. So it wasn't something that one drank in a social sense, no matter how Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor looked in Cleopatra. It was something that one drank to really commune with one's maker or makers.
You know, when you think about it, there had to be some wonderment about what wine did to us. I mean, the inebriation aspect, or, you know, the alcohol alters your sense of reality.
Absolutely. But the other important factor to remember is that there was none of this was thought of with other alcoholic drinks. Beer was just about as old as wine. In ancient Egypt, for example, the most common beverage was a fermented beverage made out of date palms, or the dates from palm trees. There was no god of date palms. There was no god of beer in the way that there were multiple gods of wine throughout ancient cultures. And I think the reason is that it's quite obvious to make beer or to crack open the nuts and get the fruit and make fermented date palm juice. Human beings have to do something. With wine, it's produced naturally. If a bunch of grapes falls off a vine, hits a rock, splits open, wine will start being made. It won't be the most palatable wine, but wine is a wholly natural product in that chemical sense. So wine was conceived of as a really godly substance in a way that other things that might provide inebriation weren't.
The other thing is, though, your main point is that the wine we drink today is a modern invention. When did wine become modern?
Wine became modern, or the origins of the wines that we drink today, started in the Renaissance and gained momentum during the Enlightenment and into the 19th century, which is you know, not yesterday,
right,
but in the course of human history is really pretty recent. Wine is 8,000 years old, and wine as we know it is about 200 years old.
Uh-huh. Was this just a natural evolution of how wine was made and these additives began to fall away? Or was it a whole change of attitude of what wine was and how it played again in people's lives?
I would say it's equally both. The crucial things that made wine different were really the invention of glass bottles and cork stoppers that would enable wine to not turn bad very quickly. For thousands and thousands of years, wine soured within days, if not hours, of when it's first made.
Ah.
Starting in the 18th century, we could have a product that, by that point, wholly secular, nobody's thinking of wine in spiritual terms anymore, that can last. And this leads to the first people who start collecting wine, valuing certain vintages and all those kinds of things. But corresponding with this, as you suggest, are radical changes in how people think of it, that wine is something that becomes a mark of taste, of good taste, of refinement, of sophistication. Mm-hmm. And that's a very different attitude than existed previously.
Fascinating. Really fascinating. Paul, thank you.
You're most welcome.
Paul Lucas is the author of Inventing Wine, A New History of One of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures. Well, it is time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question this week is, how do you make your own golden goose and golden eggs? Well, we're going to be back with that answer and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. But before we get together, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how do you make your own golden goose and golden eggs? Well, you may need to get yourself to Germany to buy the latest edible spray paint. The Deli Garage Food Cooperative in Germany now makes edible sprays in gold, chrome, red, and blue. Not yet available here. But wait a minute. Come to think of it, cake decorators use spray colors. So why not a golden goose on a bed of golden eggs? How about turning the kids loose with pink spray for the green beans? And how about I quit while I'm somewhat ahead? Time for your calls. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Let's see, who are we going to talk to first? We've got Annie on the line from Aberdeenshire, Scotland. Annie, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Well, that's pretty swell. So what can we do for you?
Okay. Well, I am an artist at a sculpture center here, and we are in a pretty rural location. And a couple of our favorite things that we have found at the farmer's market up here is venison and a farmer that grows multiple varieties of heirloom potatoes. So we're looking for how to do justice to both in a stew.
Now whereabouts are you in Scotland?
We are in northeast Scotland. We're near Aberdeen. It's about 4 hours north of Edinburgh.
Oh, my. So you're really out there, aren't you?
Yes, really, really.
What an adventure. Are you there for a long period of time?
3 months, actually, yes.
Ah, so heirloom potatoes and venison.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Let's think. Okay, now. And you want to make this into a meal, I gather?
A stew. We've done shepherd's pie twice with it, so now we're looking maybe to do a stew.
A stew, because you know what I was thinking, to show off those heirloom potatoes.
Yeah.
You know what would be nice to do? Do you have access to some dairy?
Oh, yeah.
I would imagine you would in Scotland.
Yeah, there's lots of cows.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's what I was thinking. Because what I was wondering is, you could do the venison stew, but what would might be nice is to slice up those potatoes, okay, and to layer them, overlap the slices with a bit of garlic, not a lot, and some grated nutmeg, and do a bit of broth and cream, you know, in a shallow dish, and slow bake them in the oven. So you have the different types of potatoes that you can taste them. And then you could braise your venison in a bit of wine and some celery, carrot, and onion, and some potatoes as well. I mean, you don't want to, you've got heirloom potatoes. What kind of heirlooms do you have?
He has a different collection at the market each week, so sometimes you'll have some salad ones and then some flowery ones, and I don't remember all their names. He has so many kinds.
All right, let's do the salad ones would be the ones you would use for, this would be a gratin you're making.
Okay.
Okay, and so the salad ones would go into the gratin, okay, because that you want them to be ones that hold together.
Okay.
And then I think the flowery ones... Let's celebrate these potatoes. Let's do two potato dishes and a venison stew. How about that?
Okay.
All right. I'm changing gears here. Okay. So you're going to do this. You're going to do some venison broth from some bones from the venison.
Okay.
All right. So that's going to be done. And that'll go into the, you want to slice the potatoes and layer them with a bit of, we're going to do butter, nutmeg, and a bit of garlic.
Okay.
And you're going to overlap them so they're fanned out so you can, you know, have those potatoes in a shallow dish. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to almost cover them with broth.
Okay.
Almost just about cover them with broth. Cover them with some foil or parchment. Put them in about a 325 degree oven and let them cook for about an hour or so until they're almost tender.
Okay.
And then you're going to pour some good cream over them.
Right. Now, they have here, they have single cream and double cream. I don't know what they mean.
Well, that's light cream and heavy cream.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you want heavy cream now.
Okay.
And you want that heavy cream because the broth is going to have gone into the potatoes, and you want to pour enough heavy cream again to almost cover the potatoes.
Okay.
They're still kind of firm.
All right.
Now you're going to uncover them and let them cook another half hour or so until they're really tender, and that cream has been absorbed.
Okay.
Okay, and give them some salt. Okay, that's what you're going to do. But in the meantime, you're going to make the venison stew. In the venison stew, you're going to cut up the venison and you're going to brown it. And you're going to have some celery, carrot, and onion. You're going to brown that too.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And you're going to add some nice wine after you've browned it. And you're going to let it cook barely at a bubble. And if you've got some good bacon, you're going to put that in as well. Just a few chunks. You want that for nice flavor, okay, to give some savoriness. And if you've got any fresh herbs like thyme or savory, okay, and a little sage, that'll go in as well.
All right.
And you're going to let that bubble very, 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 very gently.
Okay.
Now, while that's bubbling, you are going to boil up some of those floury potatoes. And then you're going to mash them. And you're going to mash them with some good local butter.
Okay.
A little bit more of that cream, all right?
Uh-huh.
And you're going to chop up whatever fresh herbs that you have not put into the stew,
okay?
So if you have tarragon, for instance, they would be delicious in the potatoes.
Okay.
So you're going to have the two potatoes because you're living in a very special place.
Yeah.
The potatoes are fabulous. And it's a totally unbalanced meal, but you're going to really celebrate, okay?
Yeah.
All right, so there you go.
Wow, that sounds great.
I think it's going to be super. I think you're going to really enjoy it.
Yeah, we'll have a good time at the farmer's market. And I love listening to the podcast because it staves off my homesickness.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
But it also, it really does sound like quite an adventure.
It is, yeah.
So what made you choose being there?
Well, I applied to a lot of different international residencies, and then I'd always wanted to go to Scotland, and my family has some ancestry from here, because our last name is Campbell, which is one of the clans.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was just the right match.
I understand the food in Scotland can be quite phenomenal.
It can, yes, if you're not in the middle of nowhere.
Well, you're going to make it phenomenal.
Yes, we will.
And cash in on some of the other vegetables in the market as well.
Yeah, I think this weekend's the last one. So,
well, go for it. And thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
800-537-5252 or go to Facebook. Say hello to us. Follow us on Twitter. Send us an email. SplendidTable.org. George is calling from Los Angeles. George, what's up?
Hi. I was calling to see if you can give me some ideas to kind of wow my girlfriend. She's South Korean and I'm Ghanaian African. And so I have some dishes that I make and they are becoming kind of one way. That's all I do every time. So
well, now, what kinds of things does she like?
She likes, we often make barbecues and stuff like that with
right.
the beef. And but she loves Japanese food and she loves Italian food. She likes broccoli a lot.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes I'll make her some pasta and I buy some Alfredo sauce and stuff like that and kind of put it together. Yeah, so...
Would you like to know how to make your own Alfredo?
Oh, I would love to.
Oh, it's so easy. And that Alfredo sauce, you see, there really is no such thing as Alfredo sauce. I do a half hour on this and I rant and rave and I'm not going to bore you with it. I'll give you, I'm going to give you the down and dirty version of this, okay? This is the original Alfredo sauce and it's so easy and it's so good. All you want is some fettuccine, you know, a flat pasta.
Okay.
You know, and it's not very wide. You can use linguine or fettuccine.
Okay.
And you want a stick of butter, a pound of pasta, a stick of butter, and about a cup and a half to 2 cups of good Parmigiano Reggiano cheese.
Okay.
That's the splurge of this. Everything else
really?
Is easy. Yeah, that's it. And about a cup of heavy cream and salt and pepper. And that's it. And if you want a little garlic in it, you can. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, she likes garlic. Okay.
She likes garlic. Okay. So this is what you're going to do. You're going to put the pasta water on with a good amount of salt in it. You're going to get it to boil.
Okay.
All right. And as it comes to a boil and you drop the pasta in it, all right, you're going to put a big skillet on the stove next to it.
Okay.
Turn up the heat to medium high and put the stick of butter in it and mash up a couple of cloves of garlic.
Okay.
And while the pasta is cooking, you stir it occasionally, you're going to cook that garlic, but you don't want it to brown. You just want to warm up the garlic and you want to keep the butter just creamy. So knock off the heat as soon as the butter gets creamy.
Oh, okay.
All right. Drain the pasta, but leave a little bit of the pasta water in it. Dump it into that pan. Toss it with the butter. Add the cream. Turn on the heat now because you want to get it to, you want to get that butter to get absorbed in it. And you want the cream to get absorbed in it. It's almost like you're cooking it into the pasta. All right? Just a bit. The heat's at medium now. Salt and a lot of black pepper. Okay, generous.
Okay.
You know, not so you kill everybody, but enough black pepper to make it interesting. And
right.
Okay? And then finally, you toss in about a cup of the cheese. You taste it. You see if she likes. Ask her to taste it. And ask her if she'd like more cheese.
Oh, yes. I'm pretty sure I should say yes.
Okay. And that's her gift.
Awesome. That's
the real fettuccine Alfredo. And originally, it was supposedly created in Rome in the 1920s for two famous movie stars at the time, Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pigford. So now here you are in Los Angeles, and you're doing it for her.
that would be a great gift for her. Her birthday is in a month, so I will definitely do that and surprise her with that.
I think you can sell this one like crazy, and I think she'll love it.
That'll be awesome, and it'll be thanks to you.
Well, thank you, sir, and you guys enjoy it. Bye.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye, George. 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Community-supported agriculture, CSA for short, it's one of those double benefit arrangements. You buy a share in a farm's harvest, and all summer long you get prime produce. And the farmer gets an assured income. But then winter rolls around, and neither of you get anything. Until some farmers came up with the winter share. And Gary Brever is one of those farmers. He has Plowshare Farm in central Minnesota, and Gary's on the phone. Gary, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
So I have to tell you, I think winter share, and I see the root vegetable section of the market.
Right. And you can't just live on rutabagas and carrots alone. So what we've done is we've come up with a program to blanch and freeze things from our summer harvest, everything from, you know, sweet corn to sweet peppers to tomatoes to many of the greens. And, you know, when you blanch and freeze, we really lightly blanch and then get it frozen right away. And really a lot of the nutrients and the taste and the texture are retained by doing it that way.
Well, Gary, I mean, how does this help you? Because this, I'm thinking of the profit margin on something like this. You would need equipment for this, and you need manpower.
Yeah, well.
I love it. Yeah, well, yeah.
You know, the profit margins are slim because it is a labor-intensive, you know, it's a handicraft operation.
Right.
And we do keep it at a limit. Right now, it's about 10% of our, we have a 300-member CSA. And so out of that, we have about 30 frozen winter shares. And we're competing with an industrial model where they have big machines and big, you know, to cut up everything. I mean, mm-hmm. we have a small mm-hmm. crew. But I think for us, I mean, one of the goals with our winter share is to really connect with our customers throughout the wintertime. Because, you know, at the end of the season, we deliver our last box, and then we don't see our members again until June. Well, that's a big window where the customer has to go someplace else to receive their vegetables. And so if we can at least entertain this model for a while of being able to give them produce during the wintertime with these frozen shares, that's our hope, and maybe it can expand, and maybe it can. Our goal is that it will expand and it will grow. You know, there's the idea of supporting local farms, and there's a movement of locavores. But in the middle of winter, we need to assist those people that are doing that. Mm-hmm. And so, if we can provide them some of the fruits of the summertime in the wintertime, I think that's a good thing.
Well, Gary, I wish you great good fortune, and thanks for talking with us.
I thank you, Lynn.
Gary Brever is owner of Plowshare Farm, located in Alexandria, Minnesota. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Jane Wagner, who said, a sobering thought. What if at this very moment I am living up to my potential? Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest series, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. And you can find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.